Creativity is, by definition, creating something out of nothing.
If you're an artist, you learn that the thing that you think you're creating is not the thing that you end up creating.
The idea of failure in some ways is saying, I had an idea of what I thought needed to happen or what should happen, and it turned out differently. It's actually not failure at all.
This is what art does. Art gets to the soul, gets to the place where values, where relationships, where meaning is made. It's change, evolve, grow, stretch.
We continue our exploration of transformation through capacity building. And that happens by being challenged, through suffering, and usually by getting a thorough butt-kicking by life. And then we take responsibility for all of it. That's not a matter of putting blame or shame on ourselves or anybody else for mistakes we've made or anything that someone else has done to us. But instead, it's a gift and a grace we give ourselves through taking agency and by really taking control of the reins in our own creative process, our own transformation, and our own lives.
The work that we do as creatives translates into everything else in life, particularly areas that we often think are divorced from creativity or the need for creativity, yeah. Right? It's an analytical problem. If we run the numbers, we're going to find that this is the outcome we're going to get, and therefore that is the optimal outcome, right? There's this sense, whether it's in business, whether it's in the work that you're doing in Zimbabwe and real social, you know, really engaging in shifting social paradigms. This isn't just about going and figuring out a solution that we think will work based on running certain numbers or even what worked somewhere else, what worked in the past, preconceived ideas that we have. Yeah. Is it coming into any moment where we have a challenge? Is that, can we actually bring that creative process into that? And I do think that perhaps even part of the joy and the invigoration and the invigorating feeling of tackling difficult problems, yeah, right? Is that sometimes a difficult problem can be very much a heavy weight, and it can bring us into our, you know, the dark night of the soul. It can, yeah, bring us into these deep places. Yeah. But what pulls us out, right? And what reinvigorates us?
How do we find our way out?
Right. And a lot of that, and I think most people can relate to the feeling that at some point after difficulty, there's that, the, you know, the spring, it's the spring after the, you know, after the winter, or there's the, yeah, or there's the green after the fire, right? And what is that? That is when a seed goes from being burnt to germinating,
yeah,
there is a creativity, there's something fresh and new there. And I think articulating at this point right now, that reality that has been, I think, for a lot of us and a lot of people in general, is somewhat unconscious that, oh, now I feel better, I can come
right
into this.
They don't necessarily know how.
Right. And why it came. And there actually will be creativity, right? Creativity. Ooh, I mean, there's a problem here that I want to solve. And there's an enjoyment in that. When there's an enjoyment in it, there's creativity in it. When there's no enjoyment in it, it's a task, it's a burden.
Yeah, and how to make that creativity conscious, because there are archetypes at play in the creative process. You can observe those archetypes in nature playing out in front of us all the time. It's like an open secret of nature. And there's a lot that we can learn from these analogies, like the that you mentioned, the caterpillar going into the cocoon and completely dissolving into
liquid
into carbohydrates or whatever it is, right? And then somehow out of that comes the form of the butterfly or the acorn seed. You could never know that that was going to turn into a giant oak one day, right? So there's this archetypal process that you can observe, and why not make that more conscious in our lives? Like the process of transforming a stuck relationship, you know, moving through conflict. Problem solving, creativity as a problem solving thing, but I think it's so much more than that.
Yeah. So I'd like to, so what comes up for me is approaching this from a slightly different angle and just thinking about the kind of cultural belief in technology to solve humanity's problems. So in my grandfather's day, he thought chemicals would solve the world's problems. In our day, it's computers and AI and things like that. And we even create problems for ourselves that we rely on future technologies to solve, from cryogenics to nuclear waste. And today, the last male white rhino died. So we're relying on in vitro fertilization to keep the species alive. So we rely on technology, and that's a kind of an ordinary thing. We've always relied on technology, from fire to housing and clothing, and yet I've grown up thinking, didn't really work out that chemicals or now genetics, they don't really solve social issues. They don't. So in the future, as we have more and more problems and more social issues, I look out and I think, my goodness, we're going to rely on computers and artificial intelligence to help us solve these problems. But we will only be able to use technology wisely if we understand the genesis of social problems, if we understand that they come from us and that we have to solve them in us before we can adapt our tools to solve them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So reframing our social problems as a creativity challenge means to me that we look for a wise use of technology, right? A wise use of technology, and not only a smart use of technology, because you can be clever and smart and develop horrific consequences for humanity, for species, for the planet. So the wise use of technology means to me a balance of outer tools, technological tools, and inner tools of the kind that we're talking about now. Mm. Inner tools of realizing that, oh, this challenge requires us to shift our point of origin about this problem, our perspective on this problem, our way of engaging with each other. It ultimately calls forth a different presence in ourselves so that we don't get into situations where we're trying to problem solve and like act habitually or do what we always do and regret it. And so many, many problems of the kind that Magenta works on out there in the world break down or come to an impasse because people aren't familiar with and using the inner tools. And they are counting on those outer tools to solve those problems. So, look, I'm all for technology, all for using those spreadsheets and mapping tools and computers and all of it. It's great if, and alongside, our human, social, and inner tools. So,
can you just, I mean, when you say inner, of course, I know what you mean, because this is our inner fire language, could say, the languaging that we use within our company.
Yeah.
But I need you to just say, give a definition.
Yeah. So creativity, I think a lot of people talk about creativity. There's new books on it. There's people talking about it. It's a constant theme. But when you begin to look into the creativity literature, there's very, very, very little kind of first person experiential analysis of what it means to create. I mean, there's people interview artists and they report and they say, okay, this is what artists experience, but there's a lot of neurological focus about creativity. But if you're trying to be creative, you need a first person or an experiential, an inner path, and a set of inner experiences that you can navigate so that you can feel yourself transitioning from being habitual to creative, or fixed in your thinking to unfixed in your thinking. You need that experience of that intuition, that imagination, the becoming, the creative destruction.
Yeah, death.
The death of the thing that you were working on, and the rising of the ashes from the chaos to give birth to this incredible thing. Like, you have to live through that. So early on in the episode, I mentioned that what for me is a tragedy of getting rid of the arts in public schools, because the arts are the training for that. They build up the inner experiences of these creative archetypes that you mentioned, the archetypes of the creative process. So when I say inner tools, that's a big part of what I mean, is becoming familiar with seeing that, as Otto Scharmer at MIT says, if I attend to it this way, it will emerge that way. The realities that we affect around us take their cue and reflect our inner realities, our thoughts, our perceptions, our beliefs. And so even in systems thinking, when you look at a complex social system and you analyze why is this system, the justice system or financial systems or material and waste systems and any kind of social system, you ask, why is it producing these particular outcomes? You will come back to the ideas that went into the design of that system.
Right.
You will come back to the mindsets and the paradigms and the beliefs and the traditions at the origin point of those systems. So they all come from within us.
Let's just tie that back to social problems. I really want to drive this point home, that the source of the social problems are not the systems, they are the inner lives of the people.
Right.
So, yeah, because when we come into a system, we're actually coming in with these patterns, right, and a certain amount of unfreedoms that we bring.
As individuals.
As individuals.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. We are so deeply affected by whether it's our relationships, our family, our family patternings. We have our own karmic stuff that we bring with us.
Yeah.
We have our cultural patternings and expectations, gender, our gender patternings and expectations, and all this stuff. Ultimately, now when we show up to deal with the problem, we're actually bringing all of that stuff with us. We're
all
saying,
the
let's
time.
All the time, and let's deal with this. And we actually, ultimately, we have no way to completely rid ourselves from that. I will always come to the world with my experience of where I grew up, right? The language that my mother tongue, all of these things affect my thinking.
But there is a way to differentiate between what of our background and what we bring into a situation is problematic and what can be put to use in a beneficial way.
Right.
And so that is where we as change agents and as leaders have to do our inner work so that we grow increasingly capable to inhibit that which is not going to be helpful in the intervention, in the leadership modality, and bring forth what can be helpful.
Right.
So if a leader is not doing their inner work, you will see that reflected in the organization or the country.
And there's a creativity piece to that too, right? Which is that we can develop a capacity to actually differentiate that.
Right.
But to actually be able to do that, that is creativity, I think.
Well, let's just say that creativity is by definition is creating something out of nothing. Just as a very simple definition. So, for instance, if you want to create a new social reality, that is, you're creating something that wasn't there before, because the old social reality is the thing that has to be transformed or changed or overcome. So what you're essentially trying to do in social change, let's just say that we're talking about anything from healing a relationship between two people all the way to transforming violence in a country, that these processes are essentially creative in nature. Do you think that's true to say?
When you're working in a creative process, there is an element of creating something from nothing, in that mentally you come to an empty space in order to give a new spark to existing material or existing conditions. But the medium, it isn't nothing. The medium is what it is, right? So when you engage in a medium, that pre-exists your creative spark. But when you can bring forward, I would say, fresh cognition, fresh intuition, fresh eyes on a situation, fresh awareness and fresh openness, that is the moment where a situation can go from potentially repeating itself out of routine and habit to a situation taking a new course, because now people together are looking at each other and the situation with fresh eyes and fresh intuition and fresh cognition. So that would be that in my thinking. I think of that with air quotes of beginning again, to begin again. And that's something common in many, many spiritual and occult traditions of beginning again means having right now, in this moment, fresh attention, fresh awareness, fresh openness. And so that can transform a situation from an uncreative or ungenerative to a generative and creative potential. And for me, where the creative process then kicks in is like, okay, from that spark all the way through a process of becoming and metamorphosis and discovery and connection and failure and iteration to a new reality. And that does, I think, follow kind of a span or an archetypal span. There's lots of principles at play in a creative process that apply, whether you're seeing a natural metamorphosis, you know, the unfolding of a plant as it blossoms and shoots out leaves into the bud, into the flower, or someone making a painting, or someone rebuilding a life, or a society renewing itself. There is kind of a fractal nature in all of these creative processes where you see the same steps and principles applying at all these scales and all these different mediums.
Yeah, so what I'm getting out of that is really a part of our topic for now, which is the world's problems are really creativity challenges. We can reframe them.
Yeah, that's how I see them. And that's certainly part of the positioning that we've taken in our company.
Yeah. Which is really quite an empowering thought. Instead of always being in a state of problem solving, like a classic mistake that a social lab group or set of conveners could make is, we're going to get rid of the problem. This is our mandate. We're going to solve the problem of violence in our community, or we're going to get rid of the environmental destruction, right? If you frame your mandate in that way, that's not a good setup for a social lab. But instead, if you reframe it to be, well, what is the thing that you want to actually see? You know, I want to see peace. I want to see some kind of interdependent community active here.
Right.
So, and it's a little bit, I don't know if it's the same thing, but it just seems to me that reframing from let's solve a problem to let's create something is might seem like a subtle difference, but my goodness, the setup is really different. And if you start with that, ripples out for the rest of the life of the project.
You know, you mentioned in our warm-up talk this paradigm shift.
Yeah.
I think it is a paradigm shift.
Right.
And at its heart, we're talking about a paradigm shift from human beings as observers and spectators of the world, each locked in our own brain, to a human being as implicate participant.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. For centuries in natural science, in the Western paradigm, the human being's subjectivity was removed from the arena of science so that the scientific method and results could be objective. And that is, I believe, I understand, based on a kind of worldview that subjective and objective are truly separated. That what happens in our minds and brains is not real or is not material, and the ultimate reality is really just atoms and energies, but that the psyche or the soul is a kind of misperception or byproduct, it's an illusion, and so on. We've all heard that kind of thing. So that means the human subjectivity, the human experience, is like a spectator against this more real physical world. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at systems challenges and systemic challenges, we trace our systemic challenges back to ideas and paradigms. That kind of reifies those inner domains as real. They're so real that they're ruining the planet.
Right, right.
So our mindsets, the ideas and the beliefs that we have, the values that we have, shape our policies, our rules, our conventions, our behaviors, our the way we use natural resources. And ultimately, we see the rhino die and the ocean full of plastic and the war and so forth. So the human impact on the planet, our changing its evolution, we are now implicated participants. So the worldview shift is that human consciousness is a part of the world order. It's an integral part of the world order.
And, but let's just, it has been excluded since who? I mean, this is sort of evolution of
consciousness.
Consciousness. So, but this is important.
In the history of culture. Well, it began in the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe, this idea that the basics of modern science. And without getting too far into the evolution of consciousness, the benefit of rational, clear, logical, individualized thinking is clear. We can have a greater exercise over the material world and create all kinds of amazing things. The cost of that, however, is that we are separate from the world, and we believe that we're separate from the world, and that our morality is purely subjective and illusory and so forth, that we're basically...
Inner life is purely subjective and illusory as well.
So that has led to the possibility that humans can exploit natural resources, exploit each other, and we're seeing the systemic consequences in all kinds of ways. Things that the ancient world was not capable of doing because their consciousness was different, our consciousness was different back then, we are now capable of doing, and that's brought great benefits, like medical benefits and transportation benefits and so forth, and the downside is the ocean full of plastic and the death of the white rhino and so on, and the war and so forth. So now the work that we're doing and this multi-stakeholder work and so forth with these creative projects is based on the realization that, okay, people and their values and their beliefs and the way they engage inwardly with each other has real systemic, natural, evolutionary consequences. And so that becomes where we intervene. We take people through processes where they see each other, their challenge, themselves, from new perspectives with fresh attention, and they can more productively and more freely, more creatively, more generatively engage with each other, with their system, with their policies, with their country.
But it all has to begin with this dialogue with the medium. You're being creative as you attempt to change a social dysfunction or system. There's a medium that you're creating with, and you might be tempted to think that medium is the system itself. It's the touchable, measurable, quantifiable substance that you're creating with, like a painter. But actually, it's this invisible, these social fields that exist between people. It's what's in between. And you can't touch it. You can't, it's not even supposed to exist in modern worldview. But nevertheless, this is the medium that you have to get to know, that you have some kind of, need to have some kind of taxonomy for, some kind of science, so that you can bring all the fruit of the intellect into at play.
So for example, when Antanas Mockus, the mayor of Bogota in the 90s, wanted to change Bogota and the country. Colombia had been in civil war, and Bogota was like one of the most violent cities in the world, and that was showing up in just a huge number of traffic deaths because people would run each other over at intersections. So he traced that back to the trauma of the Civil War and the resulting isolation that people felt, and apathy that people felt as they drove around. So they were disconnected from each other. Now that is an assessment that has a kind of interior dimension, so to speak. It's happening in the inner life of millions of people, but it's giving expression to people getting run over, i.e. very tangible outcomes.
Like a symptom.
So systems thinking points towards, well, if you want to change the outcomes, you have to also intervene in the inner conditions of that system or that culture. I think the important thing is to realize is this is what art does. Art presents a material plane, you know, the painting, the dance, the through the senses, the music, the speech, the words, but gets to the soul, gets to the place where values, where relationships, where meaning is made, and puts in a little gentle, loving crowbar there and says, you know, change, evolve, grow, stretch. And so what Malkus was doing was just applying that principle and asking 2 million people in the city to wake up, and he kind of jolted them awake with the mimes and the other games. Antanas Mockus, M-O-C-K-U-S, used these very artistic and playful ways of engaging these inner lives at scale for very tangible results.
Mm-hmm. He put stars in the sidewalk of people who had died as a kind of reminder. He put professional mimes, I think, how many was it? 50 or 40 of them?
It was 40, and then it was successfully,
he scaled it up pretty much right away. Yeah. He put these mimes on the worst corners, and he used the intervention of shame as his way of changing behaviors.
But in a playful way.
In a very playful
shame
way.
Shame and...
An acknowledgement.
An acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were a whole lot of cards that were handed out that had thumbs up or thumbs down, and the pedestrians could do a thumbs down if somebody violated or drove dangerously, and thumbs up for people who were more respectful. And the mimes would do the same thing. They would mime this shaming or acknowledging behavior in this playful way. And it had such an effect. It was amazing. But the interesting thing is that other cities and other places tried to do exactly the same thing, and it did not work. Right. Because
they knew the game already.
Yeah, the game was up.
Yeah, it wasn't a surprise, and it didn't have the same impact.
This picture I just got is that what that also does is it turns people back into thinking, how am I doing? Right?
Yeah.
So it's very much, because one thing that when, if you're any type of artist.
Am I being a good citizen?
Right. And it's easy for an artist to understand that when I sit down with my paint and my canvas or my camera and my subject or whatever it is, my flute and my, you know, and my staff paper, that nothing happens there unless I participate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Otherwise there's nothing. In our social, in sort of the social realm, we have this great tendency to look at the problem that we're facing, which as an artist is putting notes on a paper to make a melody.
Yeah.
The problem that we're having culturally right now is plastic in the ocean, let's just say, or that parents and children aren't talking because they are on different sides of the political spectrum.
Right.
So we have this, right? And anytime you talk to somebody about politics, particularly right now, it's always, they are crazy, right?
Yeah.
It's them, it's not me, right? Yeah. The idiots on the road, you hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a workshop the other day and someone says, don't make an excuse for being late because of the traffic. You're the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in it, you're in it. You are it. Mm-hmm. So don't tell me it's because of traffic. It's you, right? And that was, right? So in general, I think that's one of this thing about applying this artistic principle is that in art, the paint doesn't put itself on the paper. And the reality is that in our interpersonal relations, the healing that we want, the health that we want in this situation is not going to paint itself. And the same thing sort of culturally. We have to paint the plastic out of the ocean. We have to paint the healthy dialogue between those of us who believe X and those of them that believe Y.
Yeah. So what what you remind me of is the reason why we have taken, why we have spent all this time together going through the hero's journey, and why we've subjected our listeners to our hero's journey stories. You know, the reason is because if you really want to participate actively and be a part of the solution instead of being continuing to be a part of the problem, is you have to understand the nature of this terrain, of this inner life, of these invisible social fields, of this medium. And the hero's journey is a part of how you come to understand it. I once read in this fantastic book called Trauma Stewardship, where the writer, whose name I can't remember, Laura Lipsky something, she said that she believes that American society is essentially traumatized because of the stark polarities that you see, especially in the political system in this country. You only have two political parties, and they're both polarized. And this is very common in a traumatized person, because there's very little room left over emotionally for complexity. It's very hard to hold something that has many different perspectives. Things become very polarized when you're
very black and white.
And very black and white when you're living with trauma. And I think we're seeing that in America, right? So having an understanding, and maybe even an experiential, well, especially an experiential understanding of things like trauma, helps you recognize it when you see it operating. For instance, if you're working, if you want to intervene in a community of people in your area, you're an NGO who wants to go and save the children in Africa. You know, you you want to go and do some good in the world. You need to understand that if you aren't in touch with the inner reality of those people, you're not gonna help. You're not going to be able to, because you're not going to understand the nature of the medium in which you're trying to intervene. And chances are, and this happens all too often, you'll make things worse. You will not make things better. So if you're investing in understanding your own inner life, your own wounds, and you are invested in leaning into the process of healing and transformation for yourself, it's like, you know, this is a first person science. You're studying this medium of the inner life of the human being, and you will. This is how you can most efficiently come to understand the terrain of the inner life of many people. It's a fractal thing, the inner life of the human being. It's has similar properties at small scales as it does on big scales, and I find this such a revelatory and empowering concept, especially if you want to be a part of changing the world. You can do your inner work and you will discover how.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I think that's a big part of the paradigm shift, is that we apply the rigor and careful attention to phenomena that we've learned in science now to these other phenomena, these inner phenomena in ourselves and in others. It requires us to engage with ourselves very objectively and to see where we're coming short of our expectations, our ideals, where we are repeating our habits that hold us back and hold others back. And so to take really a responsibility for the inner life is to look at it like, okay, there's a bunch of chaos and a bunch of weird stuff in here that I need to now organize and filter and transform and then build capacity. And that means that I'm doing what you're talking about. And so as I do that, I get to know not only my inner terrain, but the inner terrain.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I build up capacities in spaces where old people have potential to build capacity. And then I can go into a situation with sufficient compassion, and I've put enough miles on my own wheel, so to speak, that I can look for and appreciate others' experiences, others' complexity, others' fullness, and others' richness. And I begin to really wonder, wow, what has that person experienced? What has this community experienced? What has this nation experienced? What's working at the level of trauma for this individual, for this family, for this community, for this nation? Where are we stuck as individuals, as families, as communities, as nations? And where are we building capacities at all these different scales? Because they are inner phenomena primarily that express themselves outwardly in our culture, in our political systems, and in our economic systems. Yeah. So our point of view in our company, what we've learned, I think, over the last 25 years is that if you're not changing those inner conditions, those origin points, then you're not working at the highest levels of leverage, so to speak. You're not working with the roots of the problem or the roots of the solution. You're essentially trying to change political systems and economic systems and value systems without engaging the medium in which those things are actually possible to change. But in order to do that effectively, you have to have covered that terrain. Not only, I won't put it in the past tense, you have to be working on covering that terrain in yourself. Yeah. You have to be actively engaged there.
Right.
That's my experience.
I remember when at the last presidential election, and I was driving home and listening to the radio, and I thought, wait, what's going on here? Like, I had this completely different imagination of what was going to happen. And like many people. And I thought, you know, I turned off the radio and I thought, you know, I'm responsible. I'm actually responsible for this current outcome. Because there's actually something in me that has not been the best me. Right? When I sit down and I am making a movie and I'm directing and I'm sitting in the editing room, if something doesn't work, I have to say, what did I do wrong and how do I improve that? But as a citizen of the world, the tendency is, oh, that's outside. That's the other. It's the other's problem. Right? And I think part of that, you know, in even changing the way that we look at it or shifting that paradigm is I'm a participant in this paradigm. I'm integral to this paradigm. The way I think, the way I act, the little pieces actually have a very big impact on this whole tapestry or this sculpture that is our society.
Yeah, and just to give another example, I've been thinking about racism. I mean, I'm always thinking about racism, but lately I've been thinking about this, the trauma in this country as a culture. And I think the obvious answer to why is there so much trauma is, well, slavery, first of all, and then what happened to the Native Americans, you know, genocide, maybe, right? So these two major, major traumatic things that have been there from the very founding of this the country the way that it is now. I think that's an example of, we think that racism is the problem of people of color, if we're white, maybe. But actually, we are all traumatized. We are all implicated. We are all responsible for this. And I think one of the things that Black Lives Matter and many people of color activists in this country are trying to say is that it's not just our problem. We are all just suffering so much from this. So we are all of us a part of the problem, and this is definitely in many different sort of social change methodologies. A part of the process is to come to understand that and have a visceral experience of, oh, I'm a part of the problem, because only then can people actually do anything about it. You have to arrive at that point. Otherwise, nothing can really change. And this is understood, very well understood, in social change methodologies like the social lab. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, it can become very simple to see actually how the negative effects on those who have been affronted, mm-hmm. right?
The victims.
Mm-hmm. What is sometimes harder to see, and also even harder to acknowledge, particularly without making it seem like we're excusing the perpetrators,
right.
is that actually there is a lot of pain there too.
Yeah, there's trauma.
Right,
there.
And that, you know, and as hard as it is to look at that, that is a place that where somebody will take from another, right?
Yeah.
There is trauma there. We don't, you know, a healthy human being does not steal, rape, and pillage.
Right.
Right? That is not a healthy human being.
And they don't harbor hatred.
Right. That's not healthy.
We've mentioned a lot of artists and ideas in this podcast with which our listeners may or may not be familiar. One of them is Joseph Beuys, B-E-U-Y-S, who was very instrumental in the second half of the 20th century in arts. His performances and his innovations on a formal level to take art out of the studio and into politics and into activist movements and into other spaces were influential insofar as he and others at the time sort of put the foundations in what's called today social practice. You can get a master's degree in this of mm-hmm. artists who want to apply creativity to problems in the world, not in the studio and in the gallery. I was just reviewing his work. We've got a couple of books sitting here on the table, and I remembered that one of the things that makes his work so effective is that his outer materials, his physical materials, represent interior or inner conditions. Mm-hmm. And so through a title or through a suggestion or through the little placard on the wall, he will let you into this analog, this representation. Now, you can have an experience of his work where there's an immediate impression, but it will be deepened on learning a bit of the backstory.
Yeah, right.
And so I was struck by that again to realize that, okay, he's using these outer, these sort of more tangible physical means to poke and prod the inner life. And I realized that in the multi-stakeholder methodologies, we're doing something similar. We are taking people through what looks like a guided process in a workshop and interviews and mapping exercises and distillations and syntheses. But really underneath all of that is the attentional engagement, the shift in attention from when they come into the space, I'm an expert, I know what the problem is, I have ideas. Now, I'm being extreme to make a point, not everybody's like this. But sometimes we do get people who are like, this is the way that it's got to be. And we gently help them transition from just that more self-centered point of view to a self and other centric point of view. So we get them talking to people they don't know, talking to very diverse people, talking to people who sit very far across the room, the spectrum, the ideological spectrum. And of course, a lot of care goes into the convening to make sure that in the workshops and in these processes, very diverse participants are there. And what happens when they engage with real difference is kind of systematic, opening the mind, opening the heart, the space for empathy, for listening to the other person's story and suffering, and then finally that opens the will. What would I be willing to do? And having these experiences that I wasn't willing to do, or that I haven't historically been willing to do.
Right.
And I have seen this, I have helped facilitate these processes where enemies walk into a workshop and by the end of the first evening, they're committing to actions together.
Right.
And so what the artist does with materials, we are doing with processes.
Right.
Right? So that just strikes me as a kind of an art form, if you will, that I wanted to hand to the listeners, that this art form that Boyce and others instigated around purposeful society building. He called it social sculpture, and we're using that name in our work as well, that we're sculpting the medium of society, not only in systemic innovations, new policies and practices and economic incentives and tax structures and stuff like that, but also in these more subtle places of value, identity, and relationships and meaning making together. Now, if you're interested in this, if you want to be involved, if you want to learn more, if you want to engage with this work, then by all means, check out our website, consider taking the World Making course. And if those don't appeal, that's great. Just if you take one thing away from what I'm sharing in this podcast, realize that your effectiveness to work in this way on these simultaneously inner and outer planes, so to speak, as we've been discussing, hinges in part on your own inner work, your own being, your own willingness to continually traverse your interior life, your own habits, your own capacities, and to continually improve your inner game.
Yeah. And you know, the fascinating thing is that it's not immediately obvious. I mean, we've been living with this for so long, this idea of the inner shapes the outer.
You mean we and in Magenta?
In Magenta, yeah. And Matthew as yeah. well, right? We've been talking about this for
years.
A long time. But I was in Brazil about a year ago teaching in a class, a master's class of young and not so young social innovators that were going through this intensive training process because they are going to be professional change makers. That's their job. They're social entrepreneurs. And I had them for 3 days full time. And by the end of those 3 days, I spent the whole time taking them through processes, teaching them about systems thinking, talking about creativity, and talking to them constantly about inner development. And at the end of it, a couple of the people were like, you know, before this workshop, I really didn't see that inner development had anything to do with my work in the world. I didn't engage with it. It wasn't really a thing. It's like I didn't see the point. But now I'm seeing that inner development is important if I want to go out there and change the world. But it was really hard work to get them there.
Sure. And that doesn't necessarily grow the capacity.
No, it was just getting them beginning. Convinced.
That's the right. So that's right. That's just the
beginning.
Exactly. That's just kind of the right. That's the, so I was saying the other day, that's recognizing the spine of a book on the bookshelf across the room.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and now
it's not work. Reading the book.
You haven't read the book yet.
But it does, and I think the important thing is that having the tools is what's so important.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to come to despair, mm-hmm. right? When things get hard,
yeah.
or why am I doing this? Why am I doing what I'm
doubt.
Doing? Mm-hmm. The doubt, exactly. The question is the questions are great. We want to be able to live in the question.
Yeah.
Can we live in a question without it being doubt? Right?
Which, yeah. So
it
doesn't and tools matter.
And the tools are very important. Yeah. I mean, and I mentioned the other day, you know, this kind of thing that I've been dealing with. I'm sure there's probably another one, but you know, the practice, patience, and perseverance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Is that, you know, patience, particularly now, we live in the information age, and one of the things that is very difficult is the idea of having patience, right? Or having to really explore, right? So we get this instant gratification. I wonder, blah, blah, blah. I wonder, you know, I want a new toy, and I can go on to Amazon Prime, and I can have it tomorrow for $5, and 2 days I get it. It's delivered to my door for free. Mm-hmm. Right,
I love that.
Right, it's like, exactly. I love that. Right,
especially when I'm buying a new tool.
Oh, yes, yeah. Right, because I want that tool like now. I need this instant gratification. I have a question. I wonder whatever it is. I wonder, and I can literally pull out my phone, and in 10 seconds I have the answer to my question.
Yeah.
In this work, there is no phone you can pull out. There is no Google
that there's is going no to map. Give you this. There are no blueprints. There's no templates.
Yeah. Well, there's no blueprint. There's no template, but there are tools.
Yes.
There are navigation tools.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's having the navigation tools, but then you need, that's the practice. It's the practice. And then it's the patience, because it will not reveal itself immediately.
Yeah.
And then after meditating for 5 years, 10 years, and you think, why in the world am I doing it? Whether meditation is a thing, or even if it's a practice of reading every day, or it's a practice of journaling every day, and you can get through 5 years, 10 years and say, why in the world am I doing this? I'm still struggling with X, I'm struggling with Y, and I'm struggling with Z. And now I'm going to start struggling with A right all over again, and I just got to the end of the dang
and
alphabet.
A whole other octave.
Right? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, my experience is that if you do the exercises regularly, it does not take 5 or 10 years to show benefits. But you have to do the exercise regularly for maybe 6 weeks to 3 months. But then you realize that the benefits are incremental.
Yeah, but even there, even 6 weeks and 3 months, it just takes so much patience.
It does, and it takes
it's hard. The time and space.
So I'm
saying
a big if in all caps. If you can do the exercises routinely, regularly for six weeks. Now, I know that for most people, it sounds easy, but in practice, it's nearly impossible. And you can spend 5 or 10 years trying to do the exercises consistently for 6 weeks.
Yeah. Right. And now, when I say that you can go years and not see the outcome, sure, you will notice things, right? But it doesn't necessarily have, over that time, one of two things happen. It can be like watching if you have your own child, it can be like watching your child grow in those 6 weeks. You don't necessarily see that they've grown a whole lot in 6 weeks.
No, because you're in it.
They have, but it's not immense. You plant a tree in your backyard and you don't necessarily notice, even from one season to the next, that it's changed.
That's right.
But after a few years, you see, oh my gosh, I've got a tree here.
It's like watching the clouds. Yeah. When you look at them, they don't change.
They're not moving.
If you look back 5 minutes later, they're totally different.
Right. So that's what I mean. And that's where that's patience to say, you know what? This tree is growing. There is an oak tree here, but right now it still looks like this tiny little shoot.
Yeah.